Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live on this Feast of the Immaculate Conception. So glad to be with you on this feast day, a very blessed and happy feast day to you if you are just joining us. And if you're just joining us and you don't know about the feast, well, that's what we Catholics do. We have feast days throughout the year. We have a liturgical calendar that we live by, although in the modern world, we live by it less than we used to in earlier times. And on this day, we remember Mary, the mother of Jesus, and her Immaculate Conception. I know that one's kind of controversial with some folks, not too controversial among us Catholics, however, that Mary was conceived without sin by a special grace of God, which was a fitting thing because she was to be the mother of the Savior, the mother of God himself. So we're celebrating that today. And this hour, for a little bit of fun, we've been really enjoying this year, this new thing we're doing, International Open Forums. I don't know if I introduced myself. I'm Cy Kellett, the host of this thing. And International Open Forum, we just ask people from around the world to submit their questions because it's not always easy to call from various places around the world. And even if it is easy, it's just fun to do a whole show dedicated to questions coming from all around the world. So we solicit those questions via our social media accounts, and then we get those questions in, and then we ask them to one of our apologists. Today, the apologist will be Joe Heschmeyer, our newest apologist, a great success for us this year in the year 2021, and the author of quite a few books, including the new book, The Early Church Was the Catholic Church. And for this year, also ending today, the year of St. Joseph, he wrote a book called A Man Named Joseph, Guardian for Our Times. Joe Heschmeyer, are you ready to go around the world and answer the Earth's questions?
Let's do it.
Really? Let me ask you if you can guess at this. You may already know. If you ask for questions from all of our listeners around the world, except for the United States, where do you think most of the questions come from?
Philippines.
How did you, have we been over this before? Have we told you this before? Or?
Well, also, I've just done the show enough to know that there's a disproportionate number from the Philippines. And it's great. There's a lively Catholic Answers community in the Philippines.
It's fantastic. It's so many questions from the Philippines, however, that I really believe we're going to have to one of these days just do Philippines Open Forum. Because it's just not fair. I mean, they need their own hour, in other words. But today we'll do questions from the Philippines, questions from all around the world. And it's exciting to see where the questions came from, all kinds of different places. So I won't be giving out the phone number. We'll just be sharing these questions from around the world with Joe. And I'm going to start with Nell from the internet. Nell says, "Hi. I'm from the Philippines. My question is, why doesn't God give more visible to our senses, especially we humans? Generally, we believe what we see, like what he did in the Old Testament. Don't get me wrong. I am a devout Catholic. I just want to understand better. I mean, will it not solve a lot of our concerns currently, like the disbelief of atheists and of Muslims and even Protestants? It would be very clear to them that the Catholic Church is the only one true church that Jesus Christ established, and that our Trinity is the only God there is. In other words, why does it seem that God likes playing the hiding game with us?"
Yeah, that's a great question. The hiddenness of God is a constant kind of question that we have to struggle with as Christians. And I like the point that he made about that, you know, this is the way that we come to know anything, is like through our senses, and especially through the sense of sight. Now, St. Athanasius, who was from 296 to 373, wrote a treatise called On the Incarnation of the Word. And one of the things he points out is that this is actually why we fall into idolatry. It's not just atheism. It's not just non-Christian religions generally. It's that the reason throughout the Old Testament you see people repeatedly falling into idol worship is we really want to have a God we can see. Now, we can know philosophically and logically that, like, the God who created the visible universe is not part of the visible universe. He's greater than that. He's pure spirit. He's not visible by nature. That the senses he's created in terms of the sense of sight and smell and sound and all of that are incapable of perceiving the infinite, almighty, all-powerful God in his actual essence. But, Athanasius says, God comes to meet us where we are, and he comes to meet us through the incarnation. And so in a way, he already has answered this objection. through Jesus Christ. That the second person of the Trinity, becoming incarnate, becoming a man, takes on human form and does the things that only God can do. But here's kind of the other half of that dilemma, which is that a visible God-man doing those things, we say, well, that can't be God because he looks too human. He's too visible. He's too down to earth. That's not what we want out of God either. And so, you know, he mentions Muslims in the questions. And one of the objections, the classic Muslim objections against God, or against, excuse me, against the, like, Jesus's divinity, is like, if he's God, how can he die on the cross? You know, and so the Islamic view is that Jesus is a great prophet, but that he doesn't die on the cross, because how could that happen to God? So you see the difficulty here, which is that God entering into the world is the actual answer to the problem that he's outlining, but that's not a God we're really ready to accept either. So we kind of want it both ways or neither way.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess that's the closest I can give. There's still something mysterious about the hiddenness of God. Why doesn't he answer us more directly, more obviously? But it's probably worth noting, at least, that when he has intervened, when he does answer, we often don't like what he has to say. The very first prayer, if prayer is conversation with God, the very first recorded prayer in the Bible is God saying, "Where are you?" and Adam and Eve hiding from God. That sometimes the reason we don't hear God is because we are actively avoiding listening to him.
Nell from the Philippines, thank you very, very much for the question. You'll notice on International Open Forum that often, and Nell did not do this, but often folks will give us their diocese and their parish and all that because we ask them to. We like to say all that stuff. So this, the next one also comes from the Philippines. And this comes from Nino. And Nino says, "Hi, I'm Nino from the Diocese of Asia's Latin City." I didn't know that. Zamboanga, Philippines, Asia's Latin City. They must speak Spanish there. And his question is, he says, "My question is, how can our merciful God save those people in isolation or in remote areas where his words aren't heard? Since listening to God's words and doing his will are the key to salvation."
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's one that St. Paul explores in Romans 10. In Romans 10, he points out that how can they be saved unless, how can they be saved unless they call on the name of the Lord? How can they call on the name of the Lord unless, you know, someone preaches it to them? How can they preach unless they're sent? As it is written, how beautiful are the feet of those who preach the good news. And so if you just read that far in Romans 10, it sounds like Paul is saying the people in these isolated areas literally cannot be saved. There's no hope for them. But then he does something really interesting in verse 16. He says, but have they not all heard, you know, in verse 18, but I ask, have they not heard? And he says, indeed they have, for their voice has gone out to all the earth and their words to the ends of the world. Now, what he's doing there is he's quoting the Psalms, that when it says, their voice has gone out to all the world, that it's talking about the works of God, that even someone living in isolation has evidence of the fact that there is creation and that there is thus a creator. That, you know, this is one of the remarkable things, and I think this has been verified innumerable times throughout history. If you discover some hitherto undiscovered tribe of people, or you find some lost continent, or you find some island that's, you know, inhabited, the first thing I can tell you about it is they have religion, meaning that there is this sense that there is a creator of the world and that we have some sort of obligations to that creator in justice, that we have some sort of obligations to the creator in piety, and that we should really live our lives in conformity to what that creator is saying. And that's a remarkably consistent belief that we find around the world based on, as St. Paul would say, the fact that, like, the voice of God is present in creation. And so in that sense, even the person who hasn't heard a Christian missionary in the sense we normally think about it has already heard a Christian missionary by looking up at the stars, has already heard a Christian missionary in looking at a sunset, has already seen a Christian missionary in action, but even in their own conscience, what St. John Henry Newman calls the Aboriginal Vicar of Christ, that notion that, like, you already have a voice inside you saying this is right and this is wrong, a voice that's often very inconvenient to what you want to do. All of that points to the existence of God. And so the person who responds to that is responding to God, to the Christian God. They are saying yes to God, even if they don't know him or know him by name in the same way. They can even have something of a relationship with him just in listening to his promptings and following them. So in that sense, they are connected to Christianity in some mysterious way. Now, that is not for us to say. Now, I want to be really clear when saying this. I'm not saying you can be saved without Christianity. I am saying some people are more Christian than they seem. And this is an ancient idea in Christianity. St. Justin Martyr, writing in about the 150s, talks about Socrates, of all people, as being a Christian. And he says he lives according to the logos, the word, the logic, the order of the universe. So this is someone who refused to believe in the local gods because he knew there was one infinite, uncreated God. And that is remarkable, that he was rejecting the religion that he knew in favor of a religion he didn't really know, but knew must be true, that was somewhere out there. And so that was a yes to God in this mysterious way. Now, we don't know how many cases there are like that. So we don't want to assume, oh, well, people who live in these far off places have never heard the gospel in its fullness. We should just leave them in their ignorance. That's not right. That's not a good idea. But at the same time, we shouldn't despair of the fact that there are some people we may not get to in our lifetime, but God is still merciful, and he knows what they are and aren't saying yes and no to. Final point there, we are all judged based on what we knew or had reason to know. So if you had the ability to know a certain thing and didn't know it because you didn't care, or if you knew a thing and chose not to live according to it, you're judged for that. If there's something you literally couldn't have known about, you're not judged for that. And for the same reason that no one in the Old Testament is condemned for not knowing about Jesus of Nazareth, because, of course, they couldn't have. He hadn't come yet. Those kind of issues that in a real way, a person living on an isolated island is in much the same situation as someone living before the dawn of revelation with Abraham.
Nino, thank you so much from Zamboanga in the Philippines. More questions from around the world coming up. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. It's International Open Forum this hour on Catholic Answers Live. Right back with more of that right after this.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
The Aquinas Writing Advantage Program is part of Homeschool Connections' set of online courses for your Catholic homeschool. Homeschool Connections' website is homeschoolconnections.com.
Jennifer says, behavior in the parking lot after Mass made me think twice about becoming a Catholic.
Oh, yeah, I'm with you. No doubt. Yeah, sure. I've often said I think the number one impediment to making an act of faith in the Catholic religion is Catholics.
Yeah.
Yeah, hands down. Yeah. Yeah, we're a mess.
Called to Communion with Dr. David Anders. Tonight, 11 Eastern, on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live, International Open Forum. Joe Heschmeyer here as our guest. And one of the problems that frequently afflicts us when Joe is here as our guest is I don't read the ads very well. So, Joe, I've practiced this one. Did you know that you only have 2 days to take advantage of the best Christmas sale on the internet? That's what I said, the best Christmas sale on the internet. We're giving you an extra 25% off, already discounted prices, and free shipping. How about them apples? That's your cue to get on over to shop.catholic.com, where we're right in the middle of December deal days. We've got hundreds of great Catholic resources already on sale. And now when you enter promo code MYDEAL at checkout, you save an extra 25%. Plus, we'll give you free shipping on orders over $50. What are you waiting for? Get on over to shop.catholic.com.
Wow.
That was good.
Was something else.
That was good.
It was something. It was memorable.
I fumbled a little bit at the beginning, and I was like, "Oh no! I got to keep going."
you landed well. That's okay. The important.
Yeah, I stuck the landing. That's it, Joe. I stuck the landing. I just wanted to show you that I should have a job here. I'm not giving out the phone number because all of our questions come from around the world, where it's more convenient to email the questions. It's International Open Forum. Next one comes from James. Hello, Catholic Answers. I'm from Perth in the state of Western Australia. I go to Divine Mercy Church in the suburb of Lower Chittering. I attend the traditional Latin Mass at 11:15 a.m. every Sunday. I love all of that.
I like that specificity.
That was a lot of detail. And anytime Perth is mentioned on the show, I have to say that I have a very strong opinion about Perth, Australia. it has the best pizza place on earth. Amore Mio Pizza is the best pizza. It's better than anything in Italy. Don't even give me Italy. Amore Mio Pizzeria in, I'm not kidding. I go there, Joe. You should go there. All right. So
okay. I'll just say this.
I don't know how far it is from Lower Chittering, by the way.
I lived in Italy. Yeah. I lived in Italy for 3 years. Yeah. So I have to put in at least a plug for Italian pizza.
Oh, no, it's great. Like,
it's totally different than American pizza. So if you're expecting like Pizza Hut, you're going to be, I don't know, if not disappointed, at least surprised.
Yeah.
Naples has a place called Don Michele that claims to be the best, credibly claims to be the best pizza place in the city. And the city is the best pizza place in the country, and the country's the best pizza.
Well, that's where pizza comes from, right? Naples? Naples?
Yeah, 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 it is. And so, yeah, they do the traditional pizza, which just has three ingredients. It's got tomato sauce, cheese, and what is that? Not parsley. The sprig of some green stuff. And it was actually in honor of the Italian flag. So even like the name Margherita and all that referred to the daughter of the king, you know, so it's all that stuff. But it is incredible. It's a menu with two items. So you can just choose like, do you want it like pizza with pepperoni or with like sausage on it or not? It's like literally it's a two item menu. And I feel like that's a pretty good, if you can survive that long selling two items.
Yeah. You're doing pretty good. Pizza. Yeah.
Yeah. I look forward to trying this place in Perth.
All right. So I have to get Catholic Answers to send me to Naples now. I believe that's probably in the budget. I'm sure that I'm sure they've got the money somewhere in the budget.
I'm glad we're not having this conversation during fundraising week.
Yeah. Right. And then we'll have to send you to Perth. And you can go to Amore Mio.
Well, we're like, going to Australia next year in October, right?
Who knows what's happening?
There's a Catholic
Answers. Earth, well, fair is, enough. Earth is off its axis. Who knows? But if we do, it's on me. You can have whatever you want at Amore Mio Pizza, and it's on me.
Yeah, you know, that's wonderful. I'm sure people who are outside of Australia and Naples want us to move on with this. So let's continue.
Oh, sorry, yeah, probably. But the gentleman that we're talking to, James, right now from Lower Chittering. That does, I wonder if that comes from Great Britain, that name. He is interested in this. He wants to know where to get the best pizza in Perth and on Earth. His question is, what is the Paschal mystery and what does the word Paschal mean? What is its origins? But there's more. That's so it. Sorry. I thought you looked like you were waiting for me to read more. Yeah, that's it.
Yeah, I was. It comes from the Hebrew word for Passover. So it's just like the Passover mystery. And so, of course, we apply that to the events from Holy Thursday, the Christian Passover, to Easter Sunday. So that period of time that we sometimes call Triduum, which just means 3 days, it's Jesus's Last Supper. It's his death on the cross on Good Friday. It's his being in the tomb and what's called the harrowing of hell when he goes down to the souls of the just and releases them so they can enter heaven. And then his resurrection on Easter Sunday, all of that collectively is called the Paschal mystery. And comes from the Hebrew Pasa, that becomes like Pascha and then Paschal.
All right. Thank you for that question from Perth, Australia. If you ever need any help with your pizza choices in Perth, give me a call. The next question comes from Patricio. I'm from Rancagua. I'm from Rancagua, Chile, Sagrario Parish. My question is, when and how did monogamy become the general rule for the people of Israel?
That's a good question. It depends a little bit what you mean by that. Like Jesus would say that monogamy is built into the nature of things. You know, when he is preaching in Matthew's gospel and all the synoptics on marriage, he talks about divorce and says, from the beginning, it was not so, that the two become one flesh. Like if you take what Genesis says about the unitive nature of marriage seriously, that the two spouses become one, well, then logically you can't have one guy married to four different women and one with all of them, but they're not one with each other. It doesn't make any sense. And so if you understand what Genesis is saying, then monogamy is true from the very beginning. But you've got this kind of radical message being preached at a time and place in which a lot of the local tribes had plural marriages. They had polygamy. It was pretty widespread. And then you also had concubines on top of that. And so in that, certainly the powerful, the wealthy and the elite and all of that, if you read the Old Testament, they're pretty clearly not consistently practicing this. You know, Abraham has one wife and then one concubine. Well, you know, sort of borrows his wife's maid as a concubine. And then it gets progressively worse by the time you get to people like David and Solomon. There seems to have been sort of a double standard for the rulers. It isn't one sanctioned or condoned by the Bible, but one that you can certainly see in the way people were practicing it. That, well, it's important to carry on the lineage of the king, and so for political reasons, for the stability of the people, yada, 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 we kind of turn the other way on the fact that the king has 600 wives. But even still, the Old Testament was critical of this. Like, it's very clear Solomon falls away. He starts out as a good king, a great king even, and ends up as a pretty bad one. And it's because he's led away by all these foreign women. So this radical monogamy is being preached throughout, and it wasn't being lived very consistently throughout. That changes as you get closer to the time of Christ. Greeks and Romans were much more monogamous than the ancient Semitic people were. And so it becomes much more culturally normal to be monogamous. And then the question then instead becomes much more about divorce rather than about taking multiple wives. And I think in some ways we're still dealing with that, where Christianity very clearly teaches monogamy, very clearly prohibits divorce and remarriage. And that's a radical message even today, and radical in different ways around the world. So a friend of mine from the Democratic Republic of the Congo talked about being raised by his aunt and uncle, and he said his uncle was a good guy, except that he had four wives. Like, he said he was a good Catholic, but he had four wives.
And it was that's
a big but. But I realized, like, in talking to him, that it was a little similar to the way you might say someone in the U.S. is a good Catholic, but they've been divorced and remarried outside the church. And you're like, okay, like, this is just something where culturally we've gotten numb to the severity of the sin, because these kind of, especially in sexual matters, it's very hard to convince people to restrain themselves. And especially when you get marriage and all of the romantic stuff that, and all the familial stuff and all the kid stuff on top of that, it gets very messy. So I'd say Judaism and Christianity, we see this radical message on marriage throughout, but we also see people regularly falling short of it.
Patricio, thank you very much for the question from Chile. I also want to just make a quick mention of the fact that our podcast, Catholic Answers Focus, it just so happens we just did an episode on monogamy with Dr. Keebler from Franciscan University in Steubenville, Ohio. And it was a fun episode to do because Netflix had a show on which was basically trying to kind of scientifically show that monogamy is foolish and humans shouldn't bother very much with monogamy. And so we responded to that. So if you just type in Catholic Answers Focus Monogamy, I know that that is the first thing that will come up. Catholic Answers Focus Monogamy, and you can get a whole episode on monogamy with a Catholic biologist who knows the theology but also knows the biology of the whole deal. It's International Open Forum. Joe Heschmeyer is our guest. And we go now to Great Britain. This question, let me just read it. It's from Margaret. She says, "Hi, I'm from the parish of Our Lady of Good Counsel and St. Gregory the Great in the Archdiocese of Birmingham, UK. My question concerns Anglo-Catholicism. Do Anglo-Catholics believe in transubstantiation? And if so, does the Church of Rome accept this too?"
Margaret, I like your parish name. I go to Our Lady of Good Counsel, but we don't have and St. Gregory the Great in the title.
I know, just throw in an extra thing. It kind of seems like, wow. Oh, maybe they got combined at one point.
Yeah, it could be.
And by the way, before you answer, am I supposed to say Birmingham or like Birmingham or something? Do you know how they say it in the UK?
I can't even pronounce American English. I think you're going to stump me there.
That's probably true. Yeah. All right. Sorry about that. The city of Birmingham in the UK, if we got that wrong. But
I think they've gotten to the fact that we're just so irretrievably American that they've gotten used to our pronunciation of British names, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So with apologies.
But at least we have trucks. Yeah. They have lorries. We have trucks. Come on.
Lorry is one of those words that's
Come
not
on.
A serious
Come word. On. Get with it.
It doesn't sound menacing. If you told me a lorry was coming down the street, yes, I would assume it was like a baby carriage.
He was. If you said in America he was hit by a lorry, that means like his girlfriend,
he's probably
Lori.
Fine.
Hit him. Like that doesn't hurt that bad getting hit by. You get hit by a truck, you're dead. Get hit by a lorry. I don't know.
It's in the phonetics. That soft ending with the R-R-Y sound, it's R-I-E, but it still sounds like an R-R-Y. It's like berry. You know, like the berry's not hard.
No.
It just doesn't, it doesn't connote what it should. Anyhow.
Let me just say something. We no longer have time to answer Margaret's question. So thank you for the question. Thank you for joining us for International Open Forum. No more questions from England. It gets us off off track. No, we have to take a break, Joe.
That's the problem.
Yeah, it's clearly England. It's not us. All right. I don't know where the best pizza place in the UK is, so I can't tell you that, Margaret. But we can get you.
British food is famously suspect.
Oh, you know what British people say all the time? It's gotten better. That's how they defend their food. They don't say, oh, no, it's good. They go, it's gotten better. All right.
Indian food is excellent.
We believe you, United Kingdom. Right back with an answer about Anglo-Catholicism and transubstantiation right after this with Joe Heschmeyer.
This is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Thank you for listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Most of us Catholic parents agree our number one goal in life is to pass on the faith to our children. But here's the bad news. Today's world has a million ways to steal your kid's soul. Don't be afraid, says Father Sebastian Walsh. God loves your children even more than you do, and he desires their salvation more than anything. In his groundbreaking new book, Always a Catholic, Father Walsh shows you how to cooperate with God to bring about the fulfillment of his will for your kids. Always a Catholic reminds us that keeping our kids in the faith is about the way we live our Catholicism in our own lives and as a family from day to day. Order your copy of Always a Catholic by visiting shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
This is Debbie Giorgiani.
And I'm Jerry Usher.
Join us for Take Two with Jerry and Debbie tomorrow at noon Eastern.
Now back to Catholic Answers Live.
It's International Open Forum. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. We got Joe Heschmeyer on with us as our guest, and we still have not gotten to Margaret's question from the Archdiocese of Birmingham in the UK. The question is, Anglo-Catholicism. Do Anglo-Catholics believe in transubstantiation? And if so, does the Church of Rome accept this too?
Yeah. So the question is actually really clear in one sense. Anglicanism officially in the 39 Articles condemns transubstantiation. Now, the 39 Articles are the kind of statement of belief of the Church of England. And they used to be kind of binding, where you would actually have to take an oath of allegiance to them. They don't have quite that status anymore, but they still have kind of the normative, this is what you can reasonably say Anglicans believe, dimension to it. And in Article 28, it explicitly rejects transubstantiation, saying that it cannot be proved by Holy Writ, meaning in Scripture, that it's actually repugnant to the plain words of Scripture, that it overthrows the nature of a sacrament, and that it's given occasion to many superstitions. So it takes a very negative view of transubstantiation and rejects it. Now, in spite of that, you will still find some so-called Anglo-Catholics. Now, these are Anglicans. Despite their name, they're not Catholics. They're Anglicans who are trying to preserve what they view as the Catholic tradition. of Anglicanism. If you're familiar with the history of the Church of England, they view themselves as kind of a middle way between Protestantism and Catholicism. They originally started as a schism rather than a heresy. The heresy part kind of came in later. When they first were founded, they believed in transubstantiation. The original Articles of Faith of the Church of England explicitly affirmed Catholic Eucharistic doctrine. And then it rejected it later when it became much more Protestant. So Anglo-Catholics either ignore the 39 Articles and privately hold to transubstantiation, or they believe in a real presence of some kind, that Christ is somehow present in the sacrament, but not in the form of a substantial change of bread and wine, in which case they don't believe in transubstantiation. They believe in something much more Protestant. Those are kind of the two options open to them, because their denomination does not. Now, the other half of that question is, what do we make of that? Well, they don't have a valid priesthood. They, under Edward, they changed what's called the ordinal, so that the rite of ordination changed from being an ordination of priests to ordination of Protestant pastors. And they, even though they continue to use language like priests, they got rid of the entire sacerdotal or sacrificial element to it. They reject the notion that the Mass is a sacrifice. And so they really intentionally severed that connection to the past. Given all of that, they don't have valid holy orders. Even if, let's say there's another lockdown and you go home and you say, well, I can't go to church, I'll just have Mass in my home. Well, even if you believe in the real presence, you can't consecrate the Eucharist on your own unless you're a priest. So likewise here, the Church of England, even if they decide they believe in transubstantiation tomorrow, it's not true for them without a valid priesthood. And the Catholic Church has been very clear that they don't have valid holy orders, and therefore they can't have a valid Eucharist.
Margaret, I think that was a very, very clear answer. I hope that it was helpful to you. I'm very grateful that you wrote, and happy Boxing Day. I just want to say that because I'm not going to get to say it to anybody. So do you think they say happy Boxing Day or do they Merry Boxing Day? I think they say happy. I'm going to go with happy.
I think they even say happy Christmas, which is fascinating.
Yeah, they do say happy Christmas. Yeah, right. All right. Well, thanks, Margaret. I'm going to move. We're going back to the Philippines because the Philippines is the greatest nation on earth. And also they send us the most questions. And this one comes from Humpsky. I'm from the Philippines, St. Peter's Men's Society, Lay Apologetics. I would like to ask how we can respond to the Iglesia Ni Cristo, a Unitarian sect objecting to the divinity of Christ, that he is not originally Lord like the Father, because according to Acts 2:36, he was made Lord.
That's great. It's a good question. I'd point out that when Jesus quotes the Psalms, the Lord said to my Lord, he uses that as one of the proofs that he's existed from before David. And so in that sense, it's pointing to his eternal lordship. We can talk about a sense in which the entire world comes under the domain of Jesus and his conquest over the devil. So we can talk about being made Lord in that kind of limited sense, but we don't literally mean that he wasn't Lord of the world before. We're using the term in two different ways. I think that's the easiest answer to that, that there's plenty in Scripture that refers to him as the Lord from before. Now, that's half of the question. The other half is the whole Unitarian thing. Jesus, again, I mean, maybe just look to the verse, the Lord said to my Lord, where he's distinguishing between himself and the Father in some sense. This is one of the hardest things to grasp, is that when you've got the who and the what of God, which is what the mystery of the Trinity is really all about, when we talk about three persons in one substance, what we mean is that there are three who's in God, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. There's only one what, one divine nature. So what God is one, who God is three. We don't have a lot of analogs for that in our ordinary life, because as material creatures, that's not how we operate. But that's actually one of, I would argue this is one of the proofs that this is actually true, meaning someone making up a false religion would make up something a lot easier to understand. All of the non-Christian heresies or all of the Trinitarian heresies throughout history have been simplifications of the actual truth of the Trinity. So it's just, oh, well, there's just three gods. Okay, that's very easy to understand. Or Jesus isn't fully God. He's just like a demigod like Hercules. Okay, I get that. The Unitarian thing, this is one God, one person operating in three different roles. Okay, I can get all of that. Like all of those heresies are really simple to understand because we have immediate references to them in our ordinary daily life. When we're talking about the Trinity, there's nothing in the world that closely mirrors the Trinity. All of our analogies fall short. And that's one of the signs that the Trinity doesn't originate at our level with our minds, that it actually originates with the nature of reality itself, with the divine reality that we can't fully grasp on our own, or we can't fully grasp, period. That, you know, that it, I guess, let me use a nerdy example from science fiction. One of the problems sci-fi nerds have is that the characters we see, especially in older sci-fi, tend to be way too humanoid. They look like people dressed up in costumes because that's what they were. Whereas actual aliens who, you know, evolved under dramatically different environmental conditions would probably not look anything like the creatures on Earth. So with the Trinity, when you have something that doesn't look anything like creaturely reality, that, if anything, I think points to the truth of the doctrine. Now, there's much more that could be said about all the different times where Jesus distinguishes himself from the Father. When he says on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? He's clearly not both the Father and the Son. On the other hand, he is still clearly God. You know, when St. Thomas touches him and says, my Lord and my God, after the resurrection, he doesn't become God. He is God from all eternity. John 1, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was God, and the Word was with God. He is God, but he's not the Father. That idea is present all throughout the New Testament and is hinted at even throughout the Old Testament as well.
Thank you very, very much for that question. It's International Open Forum. Our guest is Joe Heschmeyer. We better take a very, very quick break, and we'll be right back with more questions from around the world for Joe to answer.
It's all about the truth. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
If you have a few minutes a day, you can become an EWTN media missionary in your parish, in your community, or through prayer. Be a part of Mother Angelica's mission. Place your gifts and strengths in service to Christ and His Church by volunteering your time and sharing the eternal word with the world. Visit EWTNmissionaries.com today. EWTN, the Global Catholic Network.
Do you want to end abortion, halt the attack on traditional marriage, and ensure religious freedom for ourselves and for our grandchildren? To do this, we must convert the culture. St. Paul Street Evangelization is a grassroots initiative that recognizes this need and takes it to the streets. If you're interested in peacefully sharing the gospel in your area, visit streetevangelization.com to learn more.
Welcome back. Catholic Answers Live. Joe Heschmeyer, our guest on this Feast of the Immaculate Conception. You can find out more about the Immaculate Conception, well, probably almost every Catholic website in the world. But if you want to go to our website, catholic.com, and just type in the words Immaculate Conception, there's lots and lots of information there, catholic.com. As a matter of fact, there's answers to about 4 billion and 300 million, and I'm just making up a number, but there's a lot of answers to Catholic questions there at Catholic.com. We've been answering questions for decades, so there's a large library there. Just type in Immaculate Conception if you want to know about it. Joe, you ready to do more questions from the Philippines? I mean,
yeah,
from the world? Yes, we do have a lot.
I see you did there.
We're very, very grateful to our listeners in the Philippines. It's really, really nice, and especially the responsiveness that we ask for questions, and we get a lot of good ones from the Philippines. So this one's from John. He doesn't say what parish he's in or what province, but he says, "Hello, I'm from the Philippines. My question is, if God created the whole universe, the heaven and the earth, who created God, or what are his origins?"
That's a great question, and let me do my best to explain it by, it's going to seem like maybe a little bit of roundabout, but you'll see where I'm going with this. There are two possibilities. Either a thing is contingent or it isn't contingent. This is true of everything. It either is or isn't. What does it mean to be contingent? A contingent thing exists only under certain conditions. So you wouldn't exist if your parents had never met. You wouldn't exist if we didn't have oxygen. You wouldn't exist, you know, for a million other reasons. You're contingent. You have an origin. You have an end date. You won't always exist. You didn't always exist. You only exist under certain conditions. This is also true of everything around you. That, you know, you look at, you know, the light in your room, you look at your house, you look at the flowers outside, you look at the sky, you look at everything around you, and everything you see exists only under certain conditions. And this is all really important for a few reasons. Number one, none of those things could obviously be the origin of everything. But number two, they require something prior to them in order to exist. If they only exist under certain conditions, those conditions have to be present to come into being. Straightforward, right? This means that there has to be something other than what we encounter, that there has to be something non-contingent. In philosophical terms, this is called necessary. Necessary just means it doesn't exist under certain conditions. It exists under all conditions, and it has to exist. A necessary thing is, by definition, eternal. That it can't have a beginning or an end, because if it did, it would be contingent on whatever started or ended it. And so a necessary thing has to exist for all time. And we know there has to be a necessary thing, because if it was just contingent things, then what caused any of the contingencies? You see, there's a problem of origins. And so this is important for a couple of reasons, because one, it means that everything you see is not like God. And so when you're trying to understand God, it's very natural to try to put God in the category of a contingent thing, even though logically we realize that the creator of the universe can't be in a contingent thing. So here, what we know logically, contingent things can't be the origin of everything. There has to be something non-contingent, but up against the fact that just in terms of our imaginations are limited by contingency. If you want an analogy for this, you can think about it in terms of a train, like a boxcar on a train. It doesn't pull the train, but it does pull the car behind it. It can't account for its own motion, its own movement, its own existence, but it can, you know, bring along the next one. So if you came up to an intersection and you just saw a train going by and you just saw boxcar after boxcar after boxcar, well, you would realize that even though you couldn't see it, there must be an engine car driving the whole thing. There must be something responsible for the movement of all of these boxcars, but you can't see it. That's kind of the situation we're in with God, that there is a first mover, a first cause, a necessary being that's totally non-contingent. And we know this logically, not just from faith. We know this just because literally that has to be true for there to be a universe in the first place. Given all of that, the question of who created God is asking, well, who is the non-contingent being contingent upon? And that question is nonsense, that it can't be true. Now, I want to be really clear here that we're not just saying like what's called special pleading, like, oh, well, the rules apply except for God. No, it's like the rules apply for contingent things, but logically there can't just be contingent things. So if you had another non-contingent thing, another necessary thing, if you said math always exists and always will exist, it's not contingent on anything, then the question of who created math becomes a similar kind of thing, which is why Aquinas, when he's talking about this, he's actually open to the possibility of there being more than one necessary thing, more than one non-contingent thing, and then says, if that's true, then you say, well, which non-contingent thing is an explanation of its own existence. And that's where we get really hairy into the weeds. If you thought it was like technical before, trying to explain what it is for a thing to be the explanation of its own existence is where you get really into the weeds on that. And so I would just say, I'd point towards that and to say the nature of God to be, you know, when he says, I am who am, he is the kind of being who it makes sense for him to have always existed and always to exist in a way that a created being or something like that, by definition, couldn't be and will never be. So I know that's a lot of philosophy, and I'm sorry for that, but the question is a philosophical one, and hopefully that gives at least a little bit of light on it.
John, thank you very, very much for that question. I appreciate it very, very much. It just occurred to me that maybe he didn't mention his parish and whatnot because he may not be Catholic. Maybe he just saw the question and saw the opportunity and wanted to ask a question. And if that's the case, John, welcome. We're glad to have you. And if you got more questions, send them. We'll do them on a future International Open Forum or just on an Open Forum day. Joe, the next question comes from the Philippines, from the Diocese of Antipolo, the diocesan shrine and parish of Our Lady of Light. That's where Arnold goes. That's his parish. And Arnold asks this: is Yahweh the Holy Trinity or just the Father?
That's a really good question, because there are times where it seems that one person of the Trinity is speaking, and then there are times when it seems to be referring to all three persons of the Trinity. So in that sense, it seems to serve in the same role that God serves. You know, in other words, when we say God, we sometimes mean the whole Trinity. We sometimes mean just God the Father. We sometimes mean just Jesus. We sometimes mean, you know, the Holy Spirit is God. When I say that, I'm not saying the Holy Spirit is the Father. You know, so it can refer to the divine essence. It can also refer to the three persons collectively. We have some interesting kind of scriptural evidence. So there's one really cool one. When St. Paul talks about Jesus being lifted above every other name so that every knee shall bend in the heavens, on the earth, and under the earth, he's taking an Old Testament prophecy about Yahweh and applying it to Jesus. So we know very clearly from that that Jesus is certainly one of the reference to Yahweh. Philippians 2, I think it is, in which he talks about this. It's fulfilling this Old Testament prophecy about Yahweh. So in that sense, Yahweh sometimes is used to refer to Jesus, and sometimes seems to be Jesus speaking, but then other times it refers to the Father or to the tripersonal divine unity.
Thank you very much, Arnold. Appreciate the question. The next question comes from Mark in Cebu City, Philippines. It's International Open Forum. And this question, I want to say before I read the question, is addressed to you guys. That means us here at Catholic Answers. So I'm going to give my answer to this, Joe, in addition to your answer. And Darren, you're free to give your answer if you'd like. Darren is also free to not participate because as the person in charge, he's free to do whatever he wants. All right, so Mark from Cebu City asks this: just wondering what you guys think would be the toughest Catholic doctrine to defend against people who aren't Catholic but within Christianity. Okay, so to Orthodox and Protestants and any other person who claims Christianity but is not a Catholic, what's the toughest Catholic doctrine to defend in your view, Joe Heschmeyer?
Okay, I've got my answers ready, but I'm interested in what you would say. You want to go first?
Yeah, well, it's interesting that you had said answers. Do you have an answer ready, Darren? No, Darren doesn't have one? Really? All right. I would say this. This is a doctrine, and this would be the hardest one to defend to a Christian who's not a Catholic. The Catholic Church is the church founded by Jesus Christ. Yes or no? What do you think?
I mean, that seems like kind of a cop out, I guess.
What? That's
because the reason that it'd be difficult to defend
is because that's
is
the one
that
thing they
some
reject.
Other doctrine. Yeah, yeah. Let's see what you did there.
Yeah,
that's pretty good. That's pretty good. I, I'm annoyed by that answer, but I don't see the
I'm surprised that you're annoyed by it. Okay, so if I had
such a cop-out answer.
You said others. Then you said you have others.
Like, what's the hardest thing to defend about theism? The existence of God. Okay, thanks.
That's hurtful. That's just hurtful the way you did that. All right, then I'm going to pick another one, even though I don't want to, because I think my answer was perfectly good. I'm going to pick another one. That the unifying principle of the church Christ founded is the papacy.
Nice. Yeah, I think that's a very good one. I think.
Oh, yeah, you do, because you wrote the book, Pope Peter.
Well, I clearly agree with that. I'm going to give two other answers, though.
Really? I'm surprised. I thought you were going to go for the Pope one.
No, in my experience, I find that when dealing with Protestants,
okay,
the hardest doctrine to defend is the Assumption of Mary. And it's funny because there's really no reason it should be objectionable to Protestants, meaning Protestants believe in the general resurrection. They believe that one day we'll all be assumed into heaven, or we'll have glorified bodies here on earth, or something of the sort. So nothing in the Assumption seems like it should be particularly objectionable. But I've found experientially that because there's not a strong patristic support for it in the way there is for a lot of other stuff in terms of the very early church fathers, you've got some stuff, but it's not super strong. And because the biblical evidence is not as strong as it is for other doctrines, and because the way Protestants understand the way doctrine should be upheld, you know, using sola scriptura or something like it, and because they don't accept things like typological arguments, that it doesn't matter that Mary's the Ark of the New Covenant, or that we're promised that the Ark will go up with God, and we don't know what to make of this image in Revelation 12 of the mother of Jesus being enthroned in heaven, all of that stuff means that even if you lay out the Catholic case, there's often so many interpretive things going on that you have like five levels of disagreement before you even get to the Assumption. It's how do we read the scriptural evidence? How exclusively do we need to look only at the scriptural evidence? Is there a legitimate role for tradition? Is there a legitimate role for development of doctrine? All of those things. Like if you don't agree on any of those things, it's very hard to have a fruitful conversation on the Assumption of Mary, in my view. Now, interestingly, the Orthodox are basically in agreement with us on the Assumption of Mary, that this allegedly like Catholic deviation is something that Orthodox and Catholics see eye to eye on. You'll find numerous Orthodox churches named for the Assumption. They focus more on the Dormition of Mary, but they believe in the Assumption as well. So for the Orthodox, it wouldn't be that. For the Orthodox, it would probably be the papacy. The other one that I could see going there would be something like indulgences. Ironically, you know, like normally we talk about indulgences in the context of Protestants. When you get into indulgences, you're dealing with things that touch on the different conceptions we have on the authority of the church, and especially on the authority of the Pope, that all of that stuff kind of comes up. So in both cases, what I'm really saying is the hardest issues to hash out are the ones where you can't just get into the issue. You have to get into like 12 other areas related to the issue.
Yes. Okay. And I was thinking that the hardest ones were the ones that if you're interlocutor, the person you are having this conversation with, concedes them, then all the other arguments are settled, you know, and so that it would be hard to get every Christian to agree on the primacy of the Pope and the need to be in communion with the Pope and what the Pope teaches and what's taught through the councils and the popes together, like that Catholic view of the church. Because once you agree to that, all this other stuff is settled.
It's true. I'm just thinking like experientially, like in having a lot of conversations,
yeah,
particularly with Protestants, there's often, especially if you do it one-on-one where people aren't worried about how they appear to others, most Protestants seem to, if they're serious Christians, seem to have a sense that like all of this church disunity is not really what Jesus intends. It's not really good for the gospel.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And
yeah,
it would be great if we could be united, but they just can't trust the Pope because of, and then enter all the messy issues I just kind of alluded to before. Like they kind of want, a lot of Protestants want unity, want the papacy to be true, if it weren't for all the stuff that goes with it.
I gotcha. All right. Well, Joe, if you want to have some support from my position, though, I recommend you read a book called Pope Peter, Defending the Church's Most Distinctive Doctrine in a Time of Crisis. It's available now from Catholic Answers Press, written by Joe Heschmeyer.
Oh,
yourself.
Sounds good.
Should have read your own book,
Joe. Sounds like a pretty good book.
Hey, there's a lot more questions from around the world. I noticed Czechoslovakia and Romania we didn't get to. There's a bunch more from the Philippines.
Czechoslovakia? How old is this question?
No, the Czech Republic. I do that every time you're on. I say, all right, but don't interrupt me. I have to finish the show. The week after Christmas, we'll do another International Open Forum. So if your question didn't get addressed, join us again the week after Christmas for the next International Open Forum. Joe Heschmeyer, thank you for all your ridicule and for your very fine answers.
My pleasure on both counts.